When you need to do more with less, Upwork helps you hire fast without the overhead. Find expert freelancers in design, marketing, IT, AI, and more. Never tried Upwork? Now's the perfect time. Spend your first $1,000 and get $200 in credit for your next project. No upfront costs. No long-term commitments. Just $200 to reinvest in what matters. Go to Upwork.com/save to get started. That's UPWORK.com/SAVE. Upwork.com/save.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to Truth vs. Hollywood. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
Truth vs. Hollywood is a look at films that are based on a true story. But we don't just talk about the film. We also talk about that true story. On this podcast, we'll touch on what really happened, how that differs from the film, and why. And we'll also hear the true story through interviews from experts, witnesses, and people who were involved in it. We're looking at the filmmakers, and also we're looking out for the film fakers as well, Joanna. The film fakers.
I'm always looking out for the film fakers. All right, today we're talking about Munich, directed by the Steven Spielberg. About the hunt for Black September terrorists after the massacre of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich. It was also co-written by Eric Roth and Tony Kushner. Yes, the playwright. How many Israelis does it star? Not that many. But it does star Eric Bana as the operation head Avner, Jeffrey Rush as their handler Ephraim, and Daniel Craig as the driver Steve. The group of operatives also includes performances by Kieran Hines, Hans Zischler, Ayelet Zur as Avner's wife Daphne, and Lynn Cohen as Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. All the real people have a first and last name, but the fictional characters either have only a first name or a nickname.
The film had a solid critical reception with a 78% on Rotten Tomatoes. It was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director, but won none of them. Up top, we also have to mention the overall controversy with this film and the difficulty with making this episode of the podcast. This film is largely based on a book called Vengeance by Canadian journalist George Jonas, which refers to his source as Avner. Avner was later claimed to be Yuval Aviv, an airport baggage inspector who said he used to be Israeli intelligence. The Mossad has said they have no connection to him and he was never involved. Aviv counterclaims that the Mossad would never admit to it anyway. A report in Newsweek also says that the people killed actually had little or no connection to the Munich tragedy. The consensus is that we don't know who the assassins were or if the targets were really the Munich terrorists, but the way in which the assassinations happened is mostly real. The film is largely fictional, but as we'll talk about, many of the things that occurred in the film also happened in real life. So, Joanna Robinson, I want to ask you about your overall thoughts on Munich. What did you think of the movie before we dive into what was true and what wasn't?
Yeah, I guess I'll take you on a little mini tour of my experience with Munich, which is that I saw it in theaters when it came out because, you know, it was a Steven Spielberg movie. And if a Steven Spielberg movie comes out, you see it in theaters.
Yep.
And I remember not really caring much for it at the time. I thought it was like very slow and it left me kind of cold. And then I rewatched it again a couple years ago when I was doing sort of going through all of Steven Spielberg's films and watching all of them. And I liked it much better when I watched it that time. And then watching it for this, I actually really liked it. We can get into sort of how much fiction Spielberg is making here. And he has admitted as such, you know, like I watched some interviews with him where he's like, this isn't a documentary, this is a fictionalized version, you know, all this sort of stuff. So he's not claiming to be making, you know, a true story, but the emotions that he's going for in this, particularly as they settle on Eric Bana's character, Avner, I found really, really effective. And I thought Bana's performance was incredible, and I don't think he's ever gotten the, you know, accolades that he deserves for his performance in this film. What do you think, Dave, of this film?
Yeah, I really like this movie. I had a kind of a similar reaction to you when I first watched it. And I think something that we've seen as we've been going through all these movies is that there is a tendency for many of these movies based on real life stories to kind of offer us a series of snapshots of events without really explaining the significance of those events. It almost feels sometimes like, oh, we're showing this because it actually happened, but like we're not going to explain like why it's important. And when I first saw the movie Munich in theaters, I kind of felt like, oh, it's just kind of a nonstop series of these events, and like it doesn't hew to a normal kind of three-act plot structure, in my opinion, right? There is this gearing up of these assassins, but then it gets into kind of psychological thriller territory later on in the movie. And I just think, like, the structure of the movie I now appreciate, right? Because really what the movie's trying to say is how dehumanizing these cycles of violence are, right? For both sides. Right. And that actually was the cause of some controversy, I think. There has been some controversy around how much this movie equates the actions of the Mossad agents here with the actions of the terrorists, and like that's a false equivalency, some people say. We're not really going to get into that controversy on this podcast. That's beyond our scope. But I do think that the overall message is hard to deny, that basically a cycle of violence like the one you see in this movie, like where people are constantly taking revenge, where you snuff out these people that were bad actors, but then they're replaced by new bad actors, it really does often feel never-ending and makes it so that peace can be very difficult to achieve. And I feel like that's undeniable, and that is something that the movie does a great job of getting across.
I mean, that's the intention of the film, but a lot of it comes down to Bana's performance. Like, you see the disintegration of a human over the course of a film, and like the external way in which it takes a toll on him, you know, like his skin looks pallid, he looks a little sweaty, like all this sort of stuff at the end. But just, I think so much of this is an internal journey, and that's why it defies a three-act structure, because it's just like, it's about the transformation, the action, the climax, the resolution that's going on inside a human. And I think that can just be hard to land if you aren't going and looking for it. You know what I mean? I think that's why it took me three watches to really, really, really fall into this movie. But
yeah, I agree, because kind of the first time I watched it, I was really dazzled by a lot of the action sequences in this movie. You know, I think they are really very thrilling and well put together. And it's easy to forget that you're watching a movie about, you know, extremely dark subject matter, where these people are trying to avenge the brutal massacre that occurred at the Munich Olympics. Then the movie reminds you of that, you know, as the movie goes on, right? Like, it starts off like, hey, we're getting together this crew of assassins, and they have this nice rapport, and they each do different jobs. It's almost like a heist movie. And then the movie almost makes you complicit in how well directed it is, because you find yourself, or, you know, I did, very excited by these earlier assassination scenes. Then as the movie wears on, you realize, oh, wait, this is actually not enjoyable at all, and has like lots of consequences for all the parties involved. So that wasn't a level of nuance I was kind of ready for when I first saw the movie many years ago. And I feel right. like I finally graduated to recognizing occasional nuance in movies. So
welcome.
Yes,
welcome,
thank
Dave.
You. Thank you.
We'll maybe talk about this a little bit more later when we talk about the ending, but this movie came out in 2006, you know, just a few years after 9/11, and the closing shot of the movie makes it clear that this is a film that wanted to engage directly with what was going on with America's idea of vengeance for a massacre. So that's the context of this movie. But anytime you talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that's a live wire. And even Steven Spielberg, who, you know, is like a beloved, you know, Jewish filmmaker, angered so many people, particularly, you know, Israeli folks, with the, I mean, both sidesism is not what I would call it, but just trying to like draw a connection of empathy and, you know, thematically between the Palestinian actors at the beginning of the film and the Israeli men who are sent after them. You know, it's just, it's, which I think is, you know, the film is an empathy machine. That's what it's here for. That's what it's supposed to do. But, you know, that some people, as you mentioned, found that offensive. And so I think it's a tricky subject to engage with and a tricky film to engage with. And I'm glad we're talking about it, Dave Chen.
Indeed. Well, let's get into the movie. The film starts with solemn music and says that the movie was inspired by real events. We see hands on a fence, a group of people struggle to get over, and we are in the Olympic Village in Munich. Some American athletes think that they're also in the Olympics, these people trying to get over the fence, and they give them a hand. A few groups of people seem to meet up with each other, and as soon as they get together, they start changing their clothes, putting guns together, speaking in Arabic. We hear some ominous John Williams music. Something is about to go down.
Meanwhile, the Israeli wrestling coach is making toast in his pajamas, but he hears people at the door. The dorm has a lot of athletes, and all of them get up because of the commotion. A man forces his way into the room, and they can see he has a gun. Spielberg uses real news broadcast footage here from the time, including reporter Peter Jennings, who was stationed in Lebanon at the time and so was aware of a lot of the players involved in this event.
I think it's interesting to kind of reflect on the ways that movies like this use actual news footage to attest to their authenticity, like the movie's authenticity, right? Like the fact that they're using real footage, and they blend real footage with reshot footage really, really seamlessly here. There's this shot that you see of one of the hostage takers walking out onto the balcony. It's like one of the most famous shots from this entire event. Like there's a photo that's very famous of him standing there with his face covered. And you see that shot from inside the apartment complex where these people are staying. And it looks like the movements match up almost exactly. My assumption is that they shot the new stuff and they blended it with the old footage so that the movements matched exactly. But despite the fact that movies like this are quote-unquote inspired by real events, they will often refer to like actual news headlines, actual TV footage to kind of support that, hey, actually, what you're watching could have happened. And these movies want to walk that line of this thing actually happened, but also we made a bunch of things up, kind of. I just think it's important to keep that in mind, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. That came up in the film that came out last year, 2019, The Report, where you have Annette Bening playing Dianne Feinstein, a figure we're very well familiar with. But then they use actual footage of Barack Obama and John McCain. They didn't hire actors to play them. They used actual footage of them. And I asked the filmmakers why they did that. And, you know, part of it is, to lend this air of, I don't know, credibility, but just sort of to interplay with reality in your film. And I think especially the fact that Peter Jennings, who was not yet the big time anchor that he would become, he was still, an on the ground reporter, that does sort of wake me up. Not that I'm, it's the beginning of the film, not that I'm in danger of being asleep, but Peter Jennings is here, and Peter Jennings,
like, I know that guy,
right. And he comes from an era of news anchors where you just, we really trusted news anchors at the time. We heard them on the nightly news, that Peter Jennings is telling me what's going on feels incredibly, it's very credible.
Yeah, it gives a lot of verisimilitude to the proceedings.
Yeah.
But I think our meta point here is that despite the fact that these movies use that footage, just continue to be skeptical of whether or not it's based on a true story. I think many people listening to this probably are already, but it is interesting to note. Yeah, they do play with real life in very prominent ways in these movies, and that's very obvious in the opening of Munich. So,
yeah.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's essential prenatal multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their Essential Prenatal Multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As Jennings reports, the terrorists are known as the Black September Group, who are associated with the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Black September demands the release of 200 Arabs who are quote-unquote political prisoners. We get a shot of people watching the news in Israel and of people watching it in an Arab country. We also see the terrorists and athletes in a room, and they're figuring out what to do next, and that they now have to follow through. Associated Press journalist Aaron Heller and author Aaron Klein tell us a little bit about who Black September is. We'll first hear from Heller and then from Klein.
So Black September, like the other Palestinian groups, their goal was to put Palestinian name on the map. To this day, we still see that they want to put the Palestinian issue on the forefront. They want people to acknowledge them and notice them. Over time, these efforts to have Palestinian recognition have changed. At the time, it was doing these big terrorist attacks that would draw attention to their plight, free their prisoners, different things that they wanted to do over time. And 1972, the attack in Munich, that was their largest and most orchestrated attack.
In the refugee camps in Jordan in September 1970, this is why it's Black September, and they had to move from Jordan to Beirut. It started as a revenge actions, terrorist actions against the Jordanians.
So then in the film, we hear briefly on the broadcast that rescue efforts from the Germans were put on hold when they realized the terrorists were watching it all on TV. That's something that really happened. And the terrorists then bring the athletes to the airport, where it looks like they're going to load them into helicopters and carry them out somewhere. A crowd of reporters is outside the airport reporting from the ground. Germany is sending in some vehicles. But Aaron Klein says the German rescue operation was doomed to begin with.
The plan was that the hostages, the Israeli athletes, will be taken by helicopters to a remote German airfield, and over there they will be waiting for them a plane that will take them from there to Egypt. The German plan was that, assuming that the terrorists will come and they will want to check the airplane, so they will have a team of special forces waiting for those to come in the airplane, and they will take over. And in this point, they will have less terrorists to deal with in the outside. So they send a group of special forces of them into the plane. The leader of this group decided he felt that it's not secure enough for them. So he took a vote. And they voted to leave. And they evacuated the airplane. To know the number of terrorists. And if you are planning this kind of operation and you put snipers, I won't call them what they had there. They weren't snipers. At the best, they were marksmen. You know, they were very poorly trained to be marksmen even. You knew how to deal with a gun, maybe. But they use only five. If you are thinking there is five, you were supposed to have something like 15 snipers waiting for the terrorists to come. Especially if you're preparing for such a huge event that you wanted to become the peaceful as much as you could. So you prepare yourself. The Germans are known to be ones who planned everything, you know? And here it was so amateurish. Nothing was planned. Nothing was organized.
I don't know if there's anything we say, but this tape is, like, horrifying, you know?
I was watching a little History Channel episode on this, and they were talking about how the Israelis came in to try to help, and the Germans were like, no,
yeah,
we got this.
The only thing I want to say about that clip from Aaron Klein that we just heard is that You'd think in a situation like this, where there's like lots of eyes on it, it's an international incident, that everyone would be super buttoned up and have all their ducks in a row. And often that's not the case. Often the people who are trying to salvage the situation, like their institutional surroundings are as chaotic as the situation they're trying to solve. So I think that is just a very sobering reminder that these crises play out in real time for all involved, not just for those watching at home.
It also seems, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but it also seems that it's like a kind of arrogance of like, we need to put forward minimal effort in order to stop these Palestinians. And I don't know if that's like an assumption they're making about the aptitude of these Palestinians, but it just seems like an arrogant play on the behalf of the Germans.
Yeah, well, we'll talk later about how German forces made a number of errors in this situation, but... Well, Joanna, in the movie, we also hear about how the German army is more or less powerless to do anything about the situation. And for context, this is because of a post-World War II law that the German army could not operate on German soil during peacetime. We also see that one man has already been shot in the movie, although they're not reporting that on the news.
In the film, we see that something explodes at the airport and it's chaos. No one knows what's going on. And everyone around the world is glued to the TV. At first, we hear reports that hostages are safe, and that Peter Jennings maybe doesn't know as much about Middle Eastern politics as he thought he did. But after a few minutes, they sadly report that they were mistaken and all of the hostages were killed. Journalist Aaron Klein says that in the aftermath, Germany received a lot of criticism for what happened, and not just for the failed rescue attempt. But he also says Israel should have been more vigilant.
The West Germany authorities responsible for the Olympic Games screwed up all the way. From the planning and during the takeover of the hostages and the terrible and tragic outcome. So if we go back to the planning, the times in the early 70s, there were all kinds of terrorist attacks, especially even German organization like the Bader-Meinhof and others, or Palestinians or others might use the Olympic Games as a tool to show the world that they exist. So it's something that the German should have taken into consideration, and to treat the sensitive or the delegations who are coming from sensitive areas in a special way. For example, the Israelis, don't put them on the ground floor. Put them in the seventh floor with a guard in next to the elevator, or two guards, and we won't have the Munich massacre. We can't blame at this part the Germans, but we should blame also the Israelis. The Israeli authorities didn't prepare in the right way for these Olympic Games. They should have come and said, listen, we don't want our delegation to be in the ground floor, with the rooms open to the street. We want them in the seventh floor. The Israeli, they had a choice. The Germans called them and say, listen, we decided to put them in the ground floor, but you'll tell us otherwise, we'll do otherwise. And the Israeli authorities didn't do it.
I think with the film doesn't exactly underline, because maybe it assumes that its audience knows more about the Munich massacre than it does, is just the optics of this event being carried out at the, you know, the first German Olympic Games since World War II. This idea that this event was supposed to underline so much about, no borders, athletes from various countries interacting with each other in a peaceful way, the symbolic importance of Israeli athletes being in Munich, marching with their flag and what that meant for them, in a post-World War II Munich, and how the burden, a lot of it was on Germany to, you know, open their arms to Israel and show the world that we have like healed this rift from World War II. And so the fact that this terrorist group chose this event, this moment, with the eyes of the world upon them, to carry out this act of terror is, I don't know, that's a bit of context that was a little lost on me maybe the first time that I watched the film. Dave, does that Does that just strike you as completely self-evident, or what do you think?
No, I think you're right. I think it's just important to keep in mind that, like, these movies can't convey all the context. Like, some movies have different ways of doing it, and this movie, I feel like, doesn't do that much of that context giving at all. You know, some might like put some text at the beginning being like, in the three decades after World War II, you know, but this movie didn't do any of that. And I think that's okay. You know, it's okay for movies to depend on your knowledge of the events leading up to something. But it can lead to a challenging viewing experience if you don't have that context.
Once again, Spielberg uses real footage here. We see Israeli TV broadcasting the funeral and listing off each of the victims, the Israeli victims of this attack. And that footage is interspersed with Israeli intelligence watching the television and naming the people that they think are behind the attacks. And this is the first time, but not the last time, that the film is going to really try to draw a close connection between the Israeli actors and the Palestinian actors. Meanwhile, Eric Bana, who plays intelligence operative Avner, is watching the funeral on TV at home. His wife, Daphna, is very pregnant, 7 months pregnant. She's worried about her husband. And even though he says he has a very boring job, she knows he's probably going to get roped into something soon. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Golda Meir, played by Lynn Cohen, calls a meeting. She's understandably very angry about the circumstances, and we hear that the IDF, the Israeli army, struck the Arab military. She makes a case for compromising their values, and she makes a decision that ultimately she will be fully responsible for. What's the decision? We'll find out soon that it's to hunt down and assassinate all the people responsible for the attack. Anki Spitzer, the widow of one of the athletes, says that many of the victims' families were at the initial meeting. And even though they didn't get a lot of information as the operation was happening, Golda promised one thing. Here's Anki.
Yeah, very soon after the massacre, all the families were invited to the office of Golda Meir, who was the prime minister at the time. The widows, the parents of the boys who are not married, and there were 14 orphans, but many of them were like 2 months old, 3 months old, so they didn't come. And she wanted to explain to us what happened and what Israel did, or what went wrong, what went okay, and so on. She wanted to talk to us about it. And then, so we listened, and at one point she also said that they had decided, the Israeli government and she in person, that they would chase and hunt these terrorists till all four corners of the earth and finish them. So I'm listening, and my Hebrew was not that good, you know, so I asked her again in English, because she was an American before she came to Israel. So I asked her, what do you mean? And she said, we will, all those people who were involved in the massacre in Munich, we will hunt them down and we will eliminate them. I said, do you mean assassinate them? She said, whatever you like to call it.
John Robinson, I want to ask you quickly about what you think of the depiction of Golda Meir in this movie, played by Lynn Cohen, as you mentioned. I feel like she comes off as very dignified and understanding of the gravity of her actions, and just like forceful in terms of the retaliation that she wants to make. I don't really know personally, you know, what she was like, obviously, but curious what you think of the depiction of this character in the film.
Yeah, I really like her. There's very few female characters in this film, and I'm happy to talk about that a little bit more, actually. But she seems soulful in a way that, you know, makes an awful decision, right? A really terrible decision that she feels like she has to make for the soul of her country, but that the gravity of it and the emotional and moral implications are not lost on her. And I think all of that really comes through in Lynn Cohen's performance.
Indeed. Let's hear from journalist Aron Heller about the real Golda Meir.
Well, let's talk about Golda Meir. Golda Meir was not a benign old grandmother. Right? Golda Meir was the Iron Lady before there was Margaret Thatcher. And so if you think about, we know Margaret Thatcher, we've seen movies about her, and oh, she was the tough one. Golda Meir was that before her and in much tougher situations. She was the only woman, basically, who was a major leader early on in Israel's establishment. There's a famous story about David Ben-Gurion, the founder, the father of the modern nation, when he was in the cabinet meeting and looked around his cabinet and he pointed to her once and said, "She's the only man in this room," which at the time, of course, was supposed to be a compliment.
Avner gets put into a car to go to Jerusalem, and we learned he was trained to be in the Mossad but hasn't been on active duty in a while. Mossad is the Israeli Black Ops, which is comparable to the CIA in America, but maybe a little bit more secretive. Journalist Dan Raviv gives us some context.
From the very start of the State of Israel, the Israelis realized that they needed an extraordinary intelligence agency. That's because the Israelis felt surrounded by enemies, and they also thought Jewish history means that there are enemies all over the world. Israel also had to get in weapons and fighters, feeling that the country's at war. From the beginning in 1948, again in 1956 against Egypt, the Six-Day War in 1967, the Yom Kippur War in 73, it wasn't just a matter of the Israelis needing a great military, they felt they needed great intelligence. And somehow the Israelis had a knack for it. From the beginning, the Mossad has a reputation in intelligence circles all around the world as being among the very best. Much smaller than the KGB or the CIA, and yet the Israelis having their knack for intelligence and being involved in so many secret missions to bring in weapons, to smuggle parts for the nuclear program, which Israel kept secret, but Israeli intelligence had to put it all together, also to have secret diplomatic relations with countries that refused in the open to talk with Israel.
At this group meeting, Golda Meir remembers Avner and his father, who is also a hero. She tells Avner that he'll undertake a mission that is mysterious, that'll remove him from his family for years, potentially. They'll never be able to tell anyone about it. They give him a day to respond. We meet Jeffrey Rush, who plays Ephraim the Handler, and we also get more exposition about Avner's family background. His father was in prison. His mother abandoned him at a kibbutz. Let's talk a little bit about Avner, the character, as depicted in the film. What did you think about Eric Bana's performance? I thought he portrayed this kind of strong, steely intellect while at the same time not being super emotive. He kind of has this blankness most of the time that I think actually kind of suits the role, because he was chosen because he's fairly unremarkable. That's what Jeffrey Rush's character, Ephraim, says to him. But what do you think of Avner overall? What do you think of Eric Bana's performance?
Yeah, you know, I think, as I mentioned, I've watched this movie three times now, and I think it was only the third time that I really got into Eric Bana's performance, and I think that's a key to the movie as a whole. And so if it doesn't work for you, then you're kind of lost, because this is the person you're following
the whole time,
right? So, you know, it really is made or broken on his performance. And there's something, and I honestly think it's in the eyes, and I don't know if that's a cop-out to say, but I think, you know, he's got a lot of stillness, a lot of stoicism, but when he starts to unravel, you see it mostly in the eyes and this like hunted expression. And I really feel like you watch him unravel. I talked about this a little bit before, but the hair is part of it too. I know that's not performance. That's the hair and makeup department. But like, he starts the film with like short-ish, really tidy hair. And I think Golda Meir like mentioned something about how tidy he is. Or he's like, oh, you just liked... Oh yeah, she says she liked him as a bodyguard because he was so neat and tidy, right? But then we see like his hair get longer over the course of the film, and just sort of like as he's in these positions that make him like, he has to be like sweaty or like, you know, covered in grime or whatever it is, like the hair gets increasingly like wilder and more tousled. And I think his expression does too. And I think that whole journey is compelling. And I was like, when I finished this rewatch of the movie, I was like, what is Eric Bana doing right now? Why did he disappear the way that he did? The answer nowadays, if there's an actor you like and they're missing, it's because they're in a TV show that you haven't heard of, because there are so many TV shows on right now.
Mm. And what TV show is that?
Dirty John is Eric Bana's TV show.
Yes, I believe he plays the Dirty John, if I'm not mistaken.
The titular John. What do you think of Avner and Eric Bana's performance?
Yeah, I think it mostly works for me. I think he does a good job, and it's interesting the conversation that he has his character has with Jeffrey Rush's character on that beach side. I thought, you know, this is something that I didn't really pause on the first time I watched the movie. But the watching it recently, you realize, A, they're having conversation about this incredibly dangerous, potentially illegal mission that they're about to go on to murder these people. All while, like, kids are playing around them and people are, like, taking selfies or whatever the 1970s equivalent of selfies were at the time. Life is just going on. And I feel like the movie's almost trying to say, like, for these characters, one is the result of the other. You know, it's because of the fact that we have people taking out these other dudes and, like, suppressing our enemies that people can have peace. And I think that's something that, like, it seems that the movie is kind of saying that both sides feel that way. The movie's all about what is home? How can we have a home? How important is home? And, like, we see this kind of idyllic situation around them having this conversation as a sign of that, I think.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I think one of the lines that is, you know, best illuminates Avner's character and his motivation comes from his wife, Daphna, who says, you know, you got put in a kibbutz and ever since then you thought Israel was your mother. And, you know, so that idea that this is a blood feud for Avner in that way, I think is interesting. And that works really well. What doesn't work well, and once again, I'm going to talk about the women in this movie probably throughout, but what doesn't work as well is Daphna saying something like, I'm not the nice, like, supportive hero's wife.
But then that's exactly the character she is
exactly.
in the movie.
Exactly. I was like, you can't just say that and then that, you know, inoculates you from criticism of this character, which is like, she's the woman on the end of the phone. That's an archetype and that's who she is. So, yeah. I mean, she's a little cooler than that archetype usually, but not by much. So, you know.
Agreed. But yeah, going back to Bana's performance, I quite enjoyed it. And I think he points out during the talk that they have, that he has with Ephraim about how, like, he was chosen because he was normal. He's not a well-known Mossad agent. He's not somebody who has been overseas a bunch and on field missions and such like that. Like, they chose these people to be invisible and not really very noticeable. And therefore, they chose people who aren't necessarily particularly good at killing people, which is something that we're going to learn more about as the movie goes on.
Yeah, too bad two of those people look like Eric Bana and Daniel Craig, extremely handsome. But otherwise, I think they did a good job of, like,
I mean, they're basically models. Why are they choosing models to go on these missions?
It's like Starsky and Hutch do missions. All right, so even with this child on the way, Avner decides he's going to take this job. It isn't mentioned explicitly in the film, but this operation was known as Operation Wrath of God. If you want to get, you know, colorful with your naming language, Avner signs a lot of paperwork and gets his operational funds, $250,000, to buy what he needs. But, you know, as anyone who has worked with an accounting department will tell you, he's got to save his receipts.
I do want to pause for a moment to reflect on this comment about the receipts. I think it's very clearly, like, a funny scene. It's meant to be comical, I think, right? That this character is like,
yeah,
make sure you save the receipts for all the people you're killing. But actually, if you think about it, accounting is a very challenging task for people who are in these kind of cells of the kind that Avner is in, right? Like, can you imagine giving someone hundreds of thousands of dollars and basically saying, hey, you're going to be cut off from us. You can't communicate with us. You need to execute this series of things, but we can't predict anything that's going to happen. P.S. Don't abuse these money privileges. Like, it's hard to execute well, and accounting just can be a real problem when you're dealing with covert organizations. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Maybe this is why Avner is forever cooking, because he's like, okay, well, we can't spend a lot of money on meals out, so I will be cooking at home.
That's why he's doing all the meal planning, really, is because of the accounting. Yeah.
So there's four other men that Avner will meet up with, but he's the team leader. Avner posits he was chosen because he's part German and, as you mentioned, Dave, pretty unknown within Mossad. Speaking of lines in the movie that lampshade things, something I like is how they're forever calling out Eric Bana's accent in this movie. They're like, where are you from? I can't quite place it. And like, you know, all the accents in this movie are like vaguely whatever they are. Daniel Craig is South African for some reason. But I just thought that was particularly funny that they kept like calling that out, particularly with Eric Bana's accent.
Indeed, indeed. So on the plane to Germany, Avner has a whole row of seats to himself, and we see a flashback to inside the athlete's apartments. Instead of loading up all the details of Munich up top, we get scenes of what happened throughout the movie. We see what happened immediately after the terrorists broke into the apartment. One of the athletes tries to break the window with a chair. One gets shot in the face. One runs out the back. This is basically to tell us that even though they thought all the hostages were alive when they got to the airport, several of them were already dead, which is an unfortunate detail from real life. Now, John Robinson, I want to ask you about the movie Munich. What did you think about the use of flashbacks throughout the movie, which climaxed in a climax, as it were, we'll get to later. But I'm curious, like, sprinkling the flashbacks throughout, it's weird. It's a weird effect because I think, first of all, it makes it seem like it's Eric Bana's character's flashbacks, you know, when it's he wasn't there. Maybe he's just reflecting on it. But what happens in the flashbacks is like basically what happened in real life. But also, you don't really understand what the full extent of the horror was until you get towards the end of the movie. So curious if you had any thoughts on how the flashbacks were used in Munich.
As I mentioned, I think there are a number of times in the film where Spielberg really wants to draw a line between these Israeli operatives and the Palestinian terrorists. Specifically the fact that, you know, we see Eric Bana and Daniel Craig's characters at one point like black their face the way that one of the terrorists has blacked his face. I believe Eric Bana puts on a hat at one point that is similar to one of the terrorist hats. So I think there are just these little like visual moments that my guess would be that Spielberg wanted to sort of keep bringing us back to the incident so that those moments would be better highlighted. Or if not that, then he definitely wanted to do that sequence at the end, in which you see the machine gun fire from the, you know, showdown at the tarmac reflect onto Eric Bana's, you know, there's a real blurring of the line between that event and what is going on with Eric Bana at the very end of the film. Maybe Spielberg felt like if he hadn't revisited the what happened in Munich throughout the film, it would feel even more disorienting to just have it there again at the end.
Right.
You know, so maybe just to like keep bringing it up so that the ending lands a bit better. Do you know?
I think you're right that it is really leading up to that scene.
Yeah.
But I will just say like these scenes are very, very difficult to watch for me. Just like
absolutely
extremely violent and very, if seemingly like very realistic in the violence, right? Like it doesn't feel like a Hollywood movie at all.
I think it's interesting. Once again, Spielberg has said he's not making a documentary, but the, you know, because nobody who was in those apartments, the athletes and the terrorists, survived the whole incident, there's no one to say what exactly happened. So what we see are some moments of bravery. Like we see one athlete could have made it out the window, but then he sees a knife and he decides to go back in with a knife and try to, you know, sort of try to be a hero, and that backfires on him. And so there are these, it's important to maybe look closely at what's depicted inside those rooms, because that is entirely, you know, script invention. And so what is the script trying to say about those moments that they've invented there?
I think that's a great point, Joanna. And I think it's just important to remember sometimes what you're seeing is speculative reconstruction and not based on actual recollections. In the case of the Munich attacks, Avner wasn't there, but Yehuda Weinstein was one of the five Israeli athletes not taken hostage. Here's Yehuda to tell what happened from his perspective.
We were six people in that apartment. There were the two sharpshooters, us, the two fencers. There was Shaul Adani. I don't know how is it called, he's a walker. And there was another guy who was just happened to spend the night in our apartment. And we all six went to the second floor. We all gathered in the sharpshooter's room and just talked about what can we do, and what should we do. I suggested that one of the sharpshooters would shoot a terrorist which was looking outside the window. When I looked outside, I saw a terrorist on my right-hand side, about 2 meters on my right-hand side. So I told him, why don't you shoot him? And he said, I'll shoot him, maybe they'll shoot the other our other person, our other people. We knew that the only way out, because when I looked outside, I saw that there was someone for sure in the front window. They were looking out the front window. So we didn't want to go out from the front entrance. So we said we'll go from the garden entrance. There was a garden entrance. And so we said we'll go out from there. And now there was the question, who goes first? So I was young, I was about 17 and a half, and I said, okay, I will run out. If they don't shoot me, I will give you a sign and you'll come after me. And that's what I did, you know, a big dress, and just ran outside. The most distinctive feeling which I remember that I was going to be hit in the small back. In a minute, in a second, you're going to be hit by bullets or whatever. But nothing happened. I went around a wall which was in the garden. I peeped around, saw that there was no one on the terrace. And I signaled the others to come behind me and after me, and they just followed.
Once he gets to Germany, Avner picks up some safe deposit boxes, puts the money in his backpack, and goes to meet the team over a nice dinner in their shared apartment slash hideout. They all go over their roles and code names as well as their day jobs. No one has a last name, which, as we mentioned, is an indication that these are all fictionalized composite characters. Kieran Hines is Carl, the cleaner, and he has these amazing Coke bottle glasses and a fedora hat, a real look. Daniel Craig is a super blonde, super fit South African man named Steve. He's the driver. Hans Zischler plays Hans, the accountant, and Matthew Kasowitz is the explosive expert Robert. He's actually a toy maker, and that will come into play later. Of course, in real life, there were more than five people involved in this operation, including a Danish operative. In fact, the main team was told there might be many groups on active duty, and they wouldn't necessarily know about each other. And here, Dave, is where I want to interject my 2020 take on this movie, which is that I know from a fact from doing some outside research that there were some women operatives, which means that this team of five could have had a female character as part of the team. And I think that would have given us at least one more female character with something to do other than like worry over the phone or seduce people or, you know, Golda Meir. So that's to me feels like a real missed opportunity. It wouldn't have been historically inaccurate. You know, like sometimes people complain about shoehorning in female characters or non-white characters into historical context where, you know, they weren't actually there. And I'm here to tell you that you could have put a woman on this team and it would not have been historically inaccurate.
Well, I think the real shame of it is that the role of women in this movie is really limited. You know, like it is in these archetypes, kind of like the Golda Meir character is probably the only one who doesn't fit cleanly into one of the many well-worn archetypes that we've seen in these kinds of movies.
I don't know, because we have Avner's mom, his wife, this assassin, and Golda Meir, basically, right? And no offense meant to Golda Meir, but like that's mother, maiden, crone is what you're looking at there. And like that's all that is. And I really think that there is clear opportunity for more dimensionality, especially on the core team here. So yeah, there you go.
But that's kind of been the case for many of the movies we've evaluated during the course of this podcast, right? They're very dude heavy, I think, is what we found.
Yeah. These gangster movies, these whatever, are very, very dude heavy. You know, like Goodfellas had room for Lorraine Bracco's
character.
Yeah,
Goodfellas probably the best movie in terms of depicting it from actually the perspective of a woman.
Yeah, Argo, I would not say is from the perspective of any woman, but at least there were, you know, some women in the mix, the middle of like everything, you know, there. So
yeah.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The first person they're looking for is Wiles Vaiter, a translator who looks to be living in Rome. And they find this out by first going through Avner's friend, Andreas, who's with this woman who supports the Red Army faction, a Palestinian group in Germany. And Avner winds up giving her a lot of money to help them go down the road to meet a man named Tony, who gives them information. As a journalist, I'm very familiar with this breadcrumb trail that Avner is on here. Like, this is you talk to the person who might know a person who might know a person who can help you. But I did want to really quickly talk about this strange scene with Andreas and his and this woman in this room, because it is almost like it's from a different movie, like an impressionistic, like it's very like eerie and surreal. And what did you make of this, Dave?
Yeah, it was really weird. I think it's basically my sense of it is it's just kind of to illustrate what Europe was like at this time, like to give some color as to what the atmosphere of things were, because you kind of, when you are experiencing the movie and these assassinations, you're experiencing like what these specific scenarios were like, but you don't really have a sense of like what the world was like outside of these specific settings that these characters are in. And so my sense was like, it's to kind of give a little bit of color to the environs of the time, you know?
Yeah, that was my sense as well, because this is the film that takes place in many, many, many different European countries.
Yeah.
And like, what's true is that what was going on in Europe wasn't just, you know, covert ops. This is, you know, this is the 70s. This is like, you know, the fact that we see some drug use in this scene feels, you know, relevant to what's going on. So a little color. It's just like, I don't know, it's almost like something out of a Kubrick film or something. It's just like, it seems like a different film altogether.
Yeah.
I don't dislike it. It's just an interesting
moment.
It's weird.
So anyway, all the men draw straws to see who's going to get the short straw. And I think like what's implied is that the person who draws the short straw is going to go with Avner to shoot YL, right?
Yes.
So we see Robert gets the short stick. So they watch as Zweiter does his routine. He does a poetry reading in front of a small cafe. And then they follow him into a cheese shop. And he's definitely a local because the owner, Artie, is aware of him and seems very friendly with him. As he walks home with his groceries and turns to go into the elevator, Avner and Robert show up behind him. They bring guns out, but Avner struggles to get it out of his belt, showing that he's out of practice. And it almost looks like he's about to have a change of heart as he tries to lower the gun, but then Robert starts opening fire and kills Zweiter. We see Carl has been tailing them, and he removes the bullet casings and everything else they left behind. With their first mission done, they celebrate and drink some wine. Journalist Aaron Klein, though, cites the controversy behind Zweiter as a target.
It took them a few years to understand that it was a mistake. That while Zweiter was not in the loop of Munich, he was not in the loop of terrorist plans, he was a supporter of he was a Palestinian. He was supporter of the cause. He was supporter of the Palestinian having a state of their own instead of the state of Israel. But he wasn't terrorist. He wasn't a terrorist. But at the time when the decision was made to assassinate him, everybody in the Israeli security apparatuses and intelligence said he is a terrorist and he's planning to come up with more terrorist attacks. So this is the reason why we have to assassinate him.
It turns out they killed the wrong guy. So I think that's a pretty extraordinary fact, which is that the first assassination depicted was not actually of someone responsible for the attack. I don't actually think the movie does a good job of making clear that that's the case either, right? What the movie does do a good job of is showing how seemingly innocuous this guy is, right? He's just walking around buying groceries, doing some poetry reading, translating things into whatever, and like that's he seems like a fairly harmless individual, not someone who would mastermind a massacre as severe as the one depicted in the movie. But yeah, I you know, it's just fascinating to reflect on the fact that, like, while this person was a supporter of the cause, he wasn't a terrorist.
Yeah, you know, the big target that they're going after is Salameh. Like, that's the person who is concretely directly connected with the planning of Munich. And he's always sort of, like, seen in the background and, like, but these other people that they go after are often humanized or surrounded by a collateral, right? Like a daughter or, you know, the young Arab man that gets shot in Greece, I think it is. And so the movie tries really hard to make these people, you know, human people, not just targets. And I think that has less to do with Spielberg wanting to generate empathy for the you know, for Palestinian terrorists, which, like, I don't think is really his aim. And it's more to drive home the cost on Avner and his friends of the people that they're killing here. And so I think this man, having come from a reading with his groceries, sort of like putting his hand up to be like, no, please don't, and getting shot anyway. That's not to say that, like, you know, Nazis in Argentina can't, like, you know, pretend to be, you know, kindly neighborhood gentlemen or whatever, you know. But, like, it strikes me that that is a very interesting choice that Spielberg makes throughout the film.
Yeah. And we should also point out that I think the movie does muddy the waters later on when Avner kind of asks, like, were all these people actually responsible? And he doesn't really get a definitive, clear answer. He gets claims that they are, but, like, he doesn't see any evidence. And there is this notion that these characters just need to trust what the government has told them, trust what their bosses have told them about who's responsible. And it's not super clear in the movie whether that trust is well-placed.
Meanwhile, in Paris, Avner meets up with his informant, Louis, played by Mathieu Amalric, at a French farmer's market. They're now looking for the next person on their list, Mahmoud Al-Mashari, who works as a PLO representative in France. Elsewhere, three of the terrorists who were captured after the event in Munich, were set free in exchange for other hostages. This outraged Israelis. This was like a big driving force actually behind the operation in the first place. So we watch our Israeli operatives see this press conference that actually happened, that three terrorists gave on television. They were sent back to Libya. Meanwhile, Robert pretends to be a journalist in order to get close to Hamashari and gets the measurement of his phone.
So then we get to the section of the movie where they try to kill Hamashari, but then they don't see that his daughter has gone in the building, and then they need to stop the assassination, and then the daughter leaves, and then they complete the assassination again. And it's a thrilling sequence, I thought. I mean, I thought it's a little bit comical, like the signals they give each other, taking off the hat, putting on the hat. It's like as you're watching as a viewer, it's very obvious what they're doing. But I think that might be intentional, right? That they're not super covert because they're not super skilled at this job quite yet. But I do think it's interesting, as you mentioned earlier, Joanna, that these characters in the movie consider civilian life to be sacred. And that generally is something that persists throughout the movie, right? Despite the fact that they're murdering these people, they do want to make sure there is as little collateral damage as possible. And they'll go to great lengths to ensure that that's the case. So Anyway, I think that's a running theme throughout the movie, and it's really evident in this thrillingly executed sequence.
When I forgot almost everything else that happened in Munich, there are two sequences that stand out to me. One is this, and then the other is the ending. Like, those are the two sort of like most electrifying images.
Kind of similar, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And what's fascinating about this scene is the sound design, because if you look closely at the scene, there are certain noises that are isolated, like the daughter's footsteps, or, you know, it's a very subjective sound design. And then at one point, at the moment when both Avner and Carl are running for the car, the sound cuts out entirely. And then it kind of zooms back in, sort of like in a sort of impressionistic way. And this film, you know, other than the ending and this moment, doesn't do a lot of like artistic filmmaking choices, but this is one of them, and I think it's interesting that they used sound so compellingly here.
Yeah.
So,
also, random note, like, one of the reasons I remember this is because before I had seen the movie, you know how when you're watching the Oscars, they play these little clips from the movies to demonstrate, like, best sound editing or best whatever, you know? This was the clip they played for Munich. I don't remember for what award, but it was of this scene. And I remember watching the Oscars. I hadn't seen Munich yet, and I watched that sequence, and I was like, wow, that looks amazing. I need to see that movie now.
I wonder if it was for sound design.
Yeah, indeed.
it's really incredible. You know, as we said, like, things don't quite go to plan, and the team seems upset with their ballistic expert that he didn't use a strong enough explosive to make sure that the target was killed on site. But he argues that he didn't want to blow up the building. The strength of Robert's bombs, both positive and negative, are going to be a running theme in the film.
As a point of fact, the movie was nominated for Best Achievement in Film Editing. I think that was the award that was being presented when I saw the clip, Joanna.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
but no sound design, although it definitely would have deserved it. Meanwhile, the news says that the Israeli embassy got a letter bomb. Ephraim is on the phone with Avner and says there were many that they flagged, but one got through, but that Avner needed to keep pressing on. Avner says he's in New York. He's actually in Israel. He's in the hospital with his mother because his baby is being born. With a family now to protect, Avner says his wife should move to New York. The next target is Hussein Abd al-Chir, who is known to be in Cyprus. Steve once again follows him to study his route, and they decide to make a bomb that will go under his hotel room bed. Avner gets the hotel room next door to him to signal when al-Chir is in bed, and we learn that Hamshari died in the hospital, so far they have successfully completed two of the assassinations they've attempted.
That night, as Avner hangs out on the balcony waiting for al-Chir to conclude his routine, he sees a couple on their honeymoon, sort of two balconies over. This is the next sort of collateral damage element of the film, right? We went from like a daughter, and now there's this like nice young couple here within the blast radius. His signal that the bomb should go off is turning off his light. And as he does it, like, this whole conversation is so fascinating to me because he's like, I'm going to be in the hotel. They're like, what if you get affected by the bomb? He's like, I'll be fine. And then he turns off the light and he doesn't even hustle to get out of the way. And then this bomb, which is triggered by al-Shir's weight on the mattress, explodes.
Yeah,
so there wasn't enough C4 last time and there was too much this time, and it almost kills the couple next door.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple things. First of all, Steven Spielberg often doesn't use symbolism in a subtle way. You know, he's occasionally very unsubtle. And I think the idea of this character waiting to turn out a light in order to kill this person, you know, I think the light is life, Joanna.
Oh, or his like moral something. Okay, anyway,
it's also his moral compass. It's, I do like, even as I say that in kind of a, like, it sounds like I'm being backhanded about it. I do enjoy, like, he makes it very operatic, right? In terms of these kinds of decisions that these characters are torn to make. And looking at this lamp, right? It's the most symbolic lamp look I've seen in a movie.
Well, yeah, it's a decision that he has to make. Like, sitting there, he's like, if I just flick this switch, this will snuff out a person's life.
Yeah.
That is the thing that I'm doing right now. And I think that comes through really well, even more so than, like, Robert's trembling hands on the bomb trigger. You know what I mean? Which we see a couple different times. But, like, this, yeah, that lamp. I don't know. I thought it worked, you know, and then you see the light go off on his face, and I think it really is compelling.
Yeah, I came off as really snarky, but also I really enjoy an unsubtle Spielberg symbolism every now and then. So I quite liked it. And then there's this spectacular shot where I don't know if it's actually Eric Bana, but it looks like him, you know, where it's in one long shot. He starts walking away from the wall, and then you see the wall explode. And that's just a really unique shot because it looks like really dangerous. You know, however they actually pulled it off from a filmmaking perspective, it just looks like it was done as though they – and it made me realize like, oh, most of the time when there's an explosion, there's usually a cut. You know, like you usually cut to the thing going off in the fire because it's really dangerous to have an explosion go off right next to a human. And that's why you don't see it in one long wide shot. But they do it here, and I think it – really shows that the danger this character is in. So I thought it was a thrilling sequence in a movie about a very serious and dark subject matter.
Yeah, and then, you know, Avner, because of his moral compass, tries to save the couple, and Carl runs in and is like, that's not our job. Our job is to get out, basically. So it's just sort of like Avner putting the operation at risk by hoping to, like, help the couple. And the team then becomes suspicious of Louis, and I believe the reason why is that Robert is saying that the C4 was a different strength than he thought it was. And I like, later we find out that Robert, you know, doesn't know a lot about making bombs. but initially he places the blame on Louis, and I don't know whether or not that's a valid thing for him to do, but that's what he does.
Well, that's one of the things I think the movie does a really good job of is, I used the term muddying the waters earlier, right? The movie muddies the waters in terms of what these characters can know in this situation. Was it Louis that gave them faulty C4? Or was the bomb maker just not very good at his job? You don't know. Were these people actually responsible for the Black September massacre at the 1972 Munich Olympics? Maybe. You don't know. You know, there's just limits to knowledge that these characters have. And you really get a sense of that with this sequence where they're trying to figure out whether Louis is responsible for messing up their mission. So moving on, without Ephraim's blessing, the team goes to Beirut to hunt the next target. This was done with the help of IDF soldiers and one of their elite units called the Sayeret Matkal. In a drove, the soldiers come up in boats and immediately change into civilian clothes. They're dressed like tourists, and some of them are dressed as women to gain the element of surprise. This whole operation was meticulously planned and known as Operation Spring of Youth. AP journalist Aron Heller tells us some more information.
Operation Spring of Youth in 1973 is one of those kind of too-good-to-be-true spy stories or military exploits. Because basically what it was going into Beirut, the heart of, you know, this militancy, this heart of this Arab, you know, city, going in to the city and killing a bunch of guys and leaving and nothing happened to you. And so what's amazing about it was just also the planning of it, the execution. They went out there on boats. The Mossad provided the intelligence. The guys who carried out were Sayeret Matkal, which is Israel's elite commando military unit. They took their boat up the shore of the Mediterranean, and then in order to avoid detection, eventually turned off their engines, got in a bunch of dinghies, and the commandos rowed their way to the coast of Beirut. And, you know, Beirut at the time, known as the Paris of the Middle East, it was a sort of dashing city. And they basically just came in on the shore and dressed up as couples. The tall Israeli men were the men, and the short Israelis were the women. And we know in retrospect some of these guys, one of the tall guys was Amnon Lipkin-Shahak, who later became Israel's military chief of staff and a cabinet minister. And one of the short ones, a woman, was none other than Ehud Barak, who became chief of staff, defense minister, prime minister, and it considered Israel's most decorated soldier. And hand in hand, they walked through downtown Beirut, dressed as lovers, as couples, until they tracked down their three targets in Beirut, went into their homes, shot them with silencers, got out, and escaped.
It's interesting that, you know, they say that Operation Spring of Youth was meticulously planned because, so the whole premise, right, is that Avner is saying, like, we should go in, it should just be the five of us, we'll, like, sneak in and sneak out and do what we do best, which is set off bombs that are either weaker or stronger than they need to be. And Ephraim's like, no, you don't go into Arab countries, we'll send the Israeli army, you don't go. They go together, and to me, what Spielberg is trying to demonstrate here is that it would have been better if it had just been the, like, elite team of assassins. There's just so much. There's just like a brutal use of force in the firefight that we see.
Yeah, it's chaos. It's just chaos as depicted in the movie. And it feels very messy. So, yeah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about the alleged moral compass of these five. And we see the Israeli army are like, you know, they gun down a woman, which I think our five would try to not do. And then we see Avner jump in front of a young boy and be like, no, don't shoot this kid. So, like, you know, the Israeli army does not have the same rules of conduct, code of conduct that our five guys do, I guess, is another point that's going on here.
Yeah.
So at the end of all this, 6 out of the 11 targets have been tracked down by our core team here. And the mission is, I guess, a success, but it'll be the last one that is. And that's the end of part one.
Yeah. So what should we look for in part two of our discussion of Munich? Things are going to go downhill for a while, and they're going to stay that way. You know how none of the five operatives have been injured or killed in Crossfire? That's because they're being set up for even more tragic deaths. But things were a little bit less bleak in real life. We'll talk about that next time on Truth vs. Hollywood. Truth vs. Hollywood is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production. It's hosted by me, David Chen.
And me, Joanna Robinson.
It's produced by Audio Boom's Rachel Jacobs, Casey Georgie, Blair Payton, and Lauren Vogel, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights, with help from James Tyndale. Joanna Robinson, until the next episode of the podcast, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me talking about films, award season films, it's Emmy season time, all that kind of stuff on Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men podcast, or also I'll be watching some fun TV shows over on Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. What about you, Dave Chen?
I have a show where I interview artists, filmmakers, and other cool people. You can find that at culturallyrelevantshow.com or search for Culturally Relevant in any of your podcast apps. You can also find me on YouTube making videos about movies at youtube.com/Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. Until next time, feel free to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and leave us a review. We'd really appreciate it. It would help this podcast to stand out amidst the crowd. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Truth vs. Hollywood.